Hey, it's Conrad Thompson, and you're listening to Grilling JR with the voice of professional wrestling, Mr. Jim Ross. Jim, how are you, man?
I'm pretty good, Conrad. Feeling pretty good today, actually, and glad to see your cheerful face, and we should have fun this morning.
We're going to have a lot of fun. I love getting together with you and talking about old wrestling, and we're doing it today, boy. We're going back 25 years to Fully Loaded 1999. But before we get into the show, I want to mention that JR is getting out on the road again, and it's happening this weekend. So if you haven't already, make your plans to see JR August 2nd from 5 to 7 p.m. The voice of professional wrestling is coming your way to Hartville, Ohio. And he's not just coming alone. His old pal Jerry the King Lawler will be there. So will Kurt Angle and The Big Show and The Godfather and Tito Santana and Summer Rae and Barbie Blank, who we knew as Kelly Kelly, and Sabu and Francine and Chavo and Shane Douglas and Sandman and Bill Alfonso. It's a who's who of professional wrestling, and it's all happening in Ohio this weekend. Now's your chance to get an autographed book from JR, get your picture with JR. It's going to be a lot of fun. And tickets are on sale now at primetime12.com. That's primetime12.com. They have all the information for where you can see JR on August 2nd. Man, I love you're getting back out on the road, dude. Tomorrow. How about it?
Yeah, it's good for me. I think it's good for me to get out of the house for a few hours, reconnect with the fans, which I love doing. And this is my second time this summer in Hartsdale. So that last turnout was really good. So they got books and they've got pictures and action figures and all kinds of stuff. So it's it should be a productive weekend, and it's an afternoon thing. What is it, 5 to 7? I think it is.
That's right. Yeah.
So convenient in that respect. So hopefully we'll have a good turnout and have fun and meet a lot of great wrestling fans and hear what's on their mind. So it's always good. It's one of the things I look forward to. I'm flying to Akron. I'm flying to Charlotte. And then I'm flying from Charlotte to Akron, and Akron is where I'll be based out of for a day. And Hartsdale is near Akron, so LeBron James' hometown, Akron. So it should be good. I'm looking forward to it. Weather's going to be nice. They got this facility is like a big warehouse type thing, and as you mentioned, a lot of NFL stars are going to be appearing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of divas, as we mentioned. So it should be good. I saw the list of who all is going to be appearing. It's pretty impressive, actually. One of the most impressive rosters that I've seen in since I've been doing these. So should be fun, man.
Yeah, the same time you'll be there. Charles Haley and Randy White will be there. The next day, I think they've got Terrell Owens and Bob Golic. I mean, it's a who's who. If you're into autographs and meet and greets, man, primetime12.com has your hookup. That's primetime12.com. And without further ado, let's talk about our topic today, man. I'm pumped because Fully Loaded, believe it or not, was just over 25 years ago at the Marine Midland Arena in Buffalo, New York. Of course, it was a sellout. You guys are hotter than donut grease, as JR would say. It's a sellout, 16,605 fans. The gate is 547,000, more than $100,000 in merch. But I want to talk to you just about the name. Were you ever involved in the naming process of these pay-per-views? Because Fully Loaded was only around, I think, like 98 through 2000, and then that was it. No more Fully Loaded's. What do you remember about the naming process and how what sort of marketing efforts went into how you named what shows and when and all that?
Yeah, that became a part of Vince's domain, and he had people that were suggesting things, there's no doubt. I didn't have a hand in that, but it was a cool name, and the show was strong. I don't recall every detail. We'll get into that, but it was good, man. I thought it was a good, and Buffalo's a good town, you know. They're struggling with is our quarterback going to be able to take us to the Super Bowl? I say yes, whether they make it there or not, but they got the quarterback to get it done. So we'll see how that all works out at the end of the day. But that was one area that I didn't, you know, I found out going early on that the least I had to get involved in the baking of the pie, the better off I was. I could focus on other things like doing a live television show with no net. You kind of got your plates pretty full.
Well, your plate's super full in 2001 because that's, I guess I should mention, 98, the July pay-per-view was fully loaded, again in 99, again in 2000. But we know July 2001 is when we're starting the invasion angle. So when we go to the invasion name in 01, we never go back to fully loaded, which I thought was interesting. Maybe one day. The Attitude Era, though, is here in full swing. Steve Austin is going to lose his CEO title to both Vince McMahon and Shane McMahon in a ladder match. And we talked about that recently on the King of the Ring episode. But the very next night on Raw, Austin would pin The Undertaker to regain the world title for the third time. Now, that night on Raw, it had the second highest rating ever in the Monday Night Wars with a 6.82 rating and an 11.2 share. Meanwhile, Nitro did a 3.59 rating and a 6.0 share. But this Undertaker match with Stone Cold, buddy, it is incredible. It gets a 9.5 rating and a 17.1 share, making it the most watched match in cable television history. It's the first match in cable TV history for wrestling to break 7 million homes and 10 million viewers. So there's 10,721,000 people here tuned in to see Stone Cold versus The Undertaker. That's just a staggering number then or now, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's the irony is that those two guys, being both perfectionists, they had great respect for each other, but I don't think that either thought that they had great natural chemistry. So I don't want to say it was like pulling teeth, but they just had different pacing and different philosophies. But they had a hell of a match, and it delivered. It delivered to this huge audience, and I was happy to see it for those guys. They deserved to have a great match, and they did.
It's an unbelievable moment when you think about it. I mean, I know that everybody talks about the Attitude Era and gravitates back to it, and I know that there is a sentiment of people, a lot of people, who think, man, we just got to let it go. We got to leave it in the past. But I think it's cool to celebrate these high watermarks. I mean, 7.2 million homes. That's just an unbelievable number. But that's where the business is here in 1999. Do you think this is the high watermark for WWE? Like, obviously at that point, but obviously, and we know now revenues are different and the way people are making money is different. And the company's worth a lot more and all that jazz. But as far as just mainstream consumer interest, do you think 99 in that Attitude Era, that might be the peak, or was it another time?
It's arguable. Certainly arguable, Conrad. I can't say for sure because we're just assuming, but I think you're on to a good point that it was really a cool timing, and it hit the right place at the right time. You can't get that many viewers without doing something right and having something that piques their interest, they meaning the fans. So it was a good time to be a wrestling fan as it is today, but I enjoyed the hell out of it. It was good for, it's fun to call matches like that with great anticipation. It motivates the broadcasters. It certainly did me. I don't know if I was on top of my game. I don't even know what the hell that is for sure. But I had a lot of fun broadcasting it with Lawler. And as you mentioned, Lawler and I will be together this weekend in Hartsdale. And that ought to be a lot of fun. Because we just haven't been able to do, with his health issues and mine, we haven't been able to get together a lot on these appearances and things like that. I've always said that somebody's missing the boat by not recording those appearances because he's a consummate performer and is funny as hell off camera as he is on camera and entertaining as he can be. So I'm looking forward to the weekend. I always look forward to working with Lawler. He seems to rise. He seemed to rise to the occasion when we had those events. He enjoyed it as much as me, and I had a great time. Some of my fondest memories in wrestling were doing these pay-per-views with Lawler, and we're underscoring some of the big matches and things like that. So I think we're at the right place at the right time, and it worked out really, really well for us.
Go see JR in person tomorrow as you're listening to this at the All-Star Sports Gallery in the Hartville Marketplace. That's tomorrow, Friday, August 2nd. JR will be there. Speaking of being there, man, you made a couple of big acquisitions. You're sort of leading the charge for talent relations. And 1999 is a big year for you guys. Early in the year, I guess February or so, you sign the former Giant from WCW. We know he's going to be known as the Big Show here. But now it's time for another major WCW star to jump ship, and it's Chris Jericho. He's going to sign a 3-year deal with Titan Sports on June 30th. His contract technically expires with WCW at the end of July on July 27th. He's got a 90-day non-compete, and there's a lot of discussion about all that. But what do you remember about Jericho coming into the WWF?
I thought it was a great get for us. Chris was experienced. He was a veteran. He understood all the little nuances of becoming and maintaining stardom in a professional wrestling environment. One of my best signees, without question. I just remember Vince was astonished how short Vince perceived Jericho to be. But he was just a great get for us. And he stayed a great get for a long time. He was very productive. Made the company a lot of money, just like he's doing now with AEW. And, he's still wrestling a lot. So I liked that aspect of his game. He had never turned down an assignment. He always loved, and he wrestled with anybody. He could have a good match with anybody, Conrad, and didn't mind doing it. Whether he won or he lost, he didn't mind doing it. So that's a team player for you. And Chris has certainly been a team player in AEW since he's been there. He's had some of the best matches that we've seen in that company. So I thought that's one of my, Big Show was a great hire, but he's an attraction guy. Big Show should never have been an everyday wrestler. You don't put those Andre the Giant types statistics and not say, well, this guy's, you don't want to see him every night. And that's not a knock on the Big Show or Andre or anybody else, but they're better kept special when they're an attraction person. And some fans get it and some fans don't. It's not a great deal to overexpose an attraction guy. Just not. And I thought that times over time, that we overexposed Big Show a little bit based on his attraction status. So, but he was a good get too. We had, those are two big hires. And I remember recruiting both guys. Jerry Briscoe was very much involved in both of them, especially Big Show, because Big Show was living there in the Tampa area where Jerry lives. And it was fun being on the road with Jerry and taking these guys to lunch and things of that nature, talking about the business. So we locked up Big Show pretty quick. Big Show was a special project for Shane McMahon, to the point that Shane gave him his name, and it worked. The name fit. So I that was two good ones for us to get that at that point in time. Two main event level stars that had longevity. And I enjoyed working with both those guys. And I don't see Big Show very often. I'll see him this weekend and at our appearance. But I don't, and I see Jericho at the AEW tapings and things of that nature. But I don't know when the last time I saw Big Show was, because I don't go to all the TVs in AEW. and for no particular reason other than I'm just not booked. And I'm fine with my role. Don't get me wrong. I'm fine with my role. And speaking of that, I hope that I get assigned to work at Wembley. It was fun going there last time. It's a unique environment. Fan base is great. The crowd is, I think they reconfigured the seats a little bit. So I'm not sure how many people we've got, how many tickets are sold. I'm going to suggest to you, Conrad, it's probably north of 50,000 tickets. So it's impressive. It's impressive numbers, to say the least.
You know, you mentioned Shane McMahon and how high Shane McMahon was on talent here in this era. This is a little bit of a departure from talking about Fully Loaded 99, but I just want to bring something up here. Just as a reminder, I guess, gosh, 6-7 weeks ago, you and I had a conversation on this show that, boy, stirred up a lot of people about the hypothetical idea of what if Shane McMahon were to do something with AEW. And a lot of people were dunking on you and I on social media about the absurdity of that and that it would never happen. And our stance was always, hey, never say never. It's pro wrestling. Right. And the following week after we got dunked on, I said, hey, I have it on pretty good authority that Shane at least has friends who used to work in WWE and now work in AEW. And they've had the hypothetical conversation. And man, people just took all kinds of shots at you and I. I'd just like for everyone to take a look at what's broken. Since we've recorded last week, that's Shane McMahon on the left and that's Tony Khan on the right. So I don't know. Doesn't look like they're out to dinner to me, but hypothetically,
where did that come from? Well, I haven't seen that.
Well, it's breaking news this morning, JR, that they had a meeting this week and clearly it's out and it's leaked and we don't know what this means. What is Shane McMahon doing in the Impact Zone? Hell, who knows? But the point is, when everybody had their pitchforks out for you and I 2 months ago, it's like, never say never in wrestling is really the adage always, isn't it, Jim?
Absolutely. And if Shane could help us, help AEW, meaning us, then Tony would hire him and Shane would accept the offer. I don't know where that is. And I had never seen that picture. That's surprising. That's it's pretty cool, actually. And Tony and his traditional bottle of water, high dollar water. That's pretty cool. Shane is just, he could add a lot. He could do some physical things, within reason. He has great name identity. People know who he is. You don't have to stop and explain. Well, now this is Vince McMahon's son. This is Stephanie McMahon's brother. This is Linda McMahon's son. All that stuff goes without saying, but if Tony's an entrepreneur and if he thought that Shane could help us in AEW, and if Shane thought he could have some fun, make a couple of paydays, I'm sure Shane is not in need of significant cash influx, but he wants to have fun and contribute. Look, the wrestling business is in Shane's blood. Where else does he go if he wants to stay in that vocation? Where else does he go? And so I'm a Shane McMahon fan. I like him. I've known him since he was in high school. He's full of piss and vinegar always, to the point of being almost humorous at times, but he's smart. And again, the audience, our target audience knows who the hell he is. And he's got a good reputation. He's not coming there, or if he does come there, to work for Tony and AEW, then, where else does he go if he wants to stay in the pro wrestling business? And I think he could help us in a lot of ways strategically, as a TV character, obviously the main thing. So, we'll just have to wait and see how that works out. I don't have any outstanding hope or any inside info that he's the guy, but he might be a new addition at some point in time. And if so, between both their creative abilities, it would be entertaining.
There's no doubt it could be entertaining. I just think it's fun that you know, there's a lot of armchair quarterbacks out there and on the internet. And man, if you've watched all this closely long enough, things you thought would never happen, happen. Eric Bischoff walking out on the stage of Monday Night Raw and hugging Vince McMahon. Didn't have that on my bingo card ever. And so many other examples we could cite. Just never say never. Let's do talk about Vince, though, because back in 1999, on the 4th of July, he had a motorcycle accident. He cracked his tailbone in Greenwich, Connecticut. And of course, it happened in his hometown there. That's where he lives, is Greenwich. But as he's coming around a corner, he's hit by a driver who's backing his car out of the driveway. And when he hits Vince, Vince breaks his tailbone. But you know Vince, he's back producing Raw the very next day. And he's in the office the day after that. Do you remember this motorcycle accident? How big of a deal was this for Vince?
Well, it scared the hell out of all of us because you don't want to lose your leader.
Right.
He's probably dodged a bullet there. I've had some tailbone issues. There, you can't get comfortable. You hurt all the time. But he, you know, he manned up. He led the troops into battle and he did it on a regular basis. So, we were lucky that he didn't have to get hospitalized for an extended length of time, but luckily that was not the case, but it was kind of scary, to be honest with you, for a while, because he managed the company so much on his own. He had so much, he had the ability and the expertise and the desire to be involved in everything. And to lose someone of that magnitude would have been very, very tough at that point in time.
Let's talk a little bit about Jesse Ventura. We just saw, talk about this for timing, Jesse Ventura backstage at Monday Night Raw this past Monday.
Yeah.
But way back when, 25 years ago, is maybe the first time that we saw Jesse pop back up. It's announced that he's going to be a part of SummerSlam 99 as the special guest referee. Now, the photo you're seeing right now on our YouTube channel is a photo of Jesse doing his legislative work. We know that once upon a time he was a mayor, and at this point, he's the doggone governor of Minnesota. So if we've got this big SummerSlam event at the Target Center in Minneapolis, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we could figure out a way to capitalize off some of that mainstream attention of a former pro wrestler now becoming the governor? But we know that, boy, once upon a time, Vince and Jesse were oil and water. What do you remember about this opportunity to bring Jesse back into the fold in 1999?
It's controversial, to say the least, Connie. Jesse had a lawsuit against WWE that infuriated Vince. Over time, it just lessened. It's funny how time can heal a lot of wounds. And it did on this occasion. I saw those pictures last week of Jesse at WWF event in St. Paul, as you mentioned. They had a full house. It did real well. And he looked like he was casual, you know, blue jeans and a ball cap, so to speak. And I felt good about that. It kind of reasserted itself as that anything can happen. That's what people say. Well, Shane McMahon will never go to AEW. Well, how do you know that? Why would you think that? I mean, you know, seriously. So it made me feel good, to be honest with you, Conrad. I thought it was nice. Jesse was happy. He and I are the same age. He's quite the character. I saw where he was going to be doing more appearances and things of that nature, which I think is cool. So, all good, man. It's all good. I like to see reconciliations. I like to see peace in the valley, so to say.
Yes, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about one of your old pals, Jerry Lawler. It's announced on July 6th that he's going to run for the mayor of Memphis. I guess he took a look at what Jesse Ventura had done in Minnesota and said, hey, I could do that in Memphis. He's 49. He's been a huge star in Memphis and in this market, I mean, basically since the beginning of his career back in 1970. So he figures, hey, man, I've got more than a quarter century here of history and career. And I mean, he's one of the top stars of the entire area. But I'm sure a lot of people were scratching their head thinking, why in the world would you want to do this? Like, you make way more money not doing this. You would actually make less money and have more scrutiny. What do you think of the king's attempt or consideration to run for mayor?
I was a little bit surprised at the beginning when he told me he was going to run for mayor. And I think my first question was, why? You know, you're going to be taking more of your time. You only got so much time. And it's going to take it out of your schedule. He wanted to contribute to his community, which I dig. I understand it. I thought that was a cool thing. And you know, the mayor's got to be kind of a PR guy. It needs to have a great name identity. Everybody's got to recognize who he is. And Jerry always appealed to, Caucasian voters and African American voters.
Yep.
They loved him. So he had the profile that a campaign manager or a campaign organization is always looking for. So, and if you just look at the facts in that respect, he was a perfect candidate. And, but I still had it was a little bit of a head scratcher to me of why he put his hat in the ring, shall we say, to run for mayor of Memphis.
His name recognition has to be nearly 100% in Memphis by this point. I mean, it's written here in the Observer that he's actually considered running for mayor since the 70s, but
all right,
given the scrutiny and the pay and the job, I mean, he really had life the tiger by the tail in 1999. So I don't know why he would have did it, but hey, he took a stab at it. And I was proud that, you know, if he wanted to do it since the 70s, he took a stab. And by the way, he beat 12 of the 15 candidates. So there were 15 people running for mayor here, and he beat 12 of them. Now, he only wound up with 11.7%, so he doesn't win. But he was running on attracting businesses to Memphis, improving the flow of traffic through Memphis, creating more parks, and decreasing property taxes. That was sort of his platform at the time. And we know, unfortunately, he didn't wind up winning, but I got to think that's for the best. That's one of those Garth Brooks songs. That's unanswered prayers right there.
Yeah. Yeah. It might have been a blessing in disguise, quite frankly, at the end of the day. But I thought he had a very honorable and pleasantly surprising showing. As you said, you know, he was very well liked. What got him was his profession of being what part of being a pro wrestler makes you a great candidate to be to lead a community, to be the mayor of a vibrant town? I thought his platform was decent. It was solid. It made sense. But I was right in the thick of all that stuff. We talk almost every day about something, and it was frustrating for him at times because, you know, you want the system to run smoother and faster than it does. That's just politics. It could be very methodical and very deliberate. And he was willing to deal with all that. And I was always very happy for him in that regard. Look, anytime you can live your dream, his dream, as you mentioned, Conrad, over the years was to be the mayor of Memphis and had that in the back of his mind for years and years. If he had ran earlier, maybe it would have been a different ball game. He might have won. But I thought he did real well. His showing was excellent. It was very encouraging, and I was happy for him. He had fun doing it till the end. Then he got when you get caught up in the muck and the mire of running for political office, it's daunting, to say the least. It's challenging as hell, and of course, being a pro wrestler in the eyes of a lot of people, just so what, you know, how's that help us? How does that help our mayor's office? But I think he'd have been a great mayor because he was a PR mayor. He wanted to bring more, as you said, he wanted to bring more business to the, outside business, tourism, things of that nature. And, I always hoped that he would win just to see how it would all work out because he had some good ideas. And to bring more people into town to do more shopping and sightseeing and eat more barbecue or whatever, was something that, I was excited to see how it was going to evolve at the end of the day.
Let's talk a little bit about some news and notes I found from Oregon that jumped off the page to me. I didn't really know this, but there's a bill that's passed, or maybe it's not actually. I guess it's decided that they're going to continue in Oregon the drug testing policy that the State Athletic Commission has. And this is a policy that has prevented at the time both WWF and WCW from running events in Oregon. They were testing for everything, recreational drugs and all the way through. But in addition to that, they were doing HIV tests too, which really jumped off the page to me. Like, wow, I guess if you're doing that in wrestling, then maybe that's a thing. But something that was written in the Observer caught my attention, and I wanted to see if you'd ever heard this story. At one point several years ago, before a show in Oregon, Hulk Hogan had the blood submitted for testing ahead of time under his name for an HIV test by the WWF, which turned out to actually be the blood of ring announcer Howard Finkel. Now, I appreciate that they've shared this story, if it's true. But, I mean, how do we know that? Like, that feels like if that were to have happened for real, that would be a double secret probation thing we don't want anybody to hear about. Wow. Right. How in the world, A, does this happen, and B, does it get out? Or C, do you even think that's real? That feels off that this would be public like that.
Yeah, it's a little awkward, say the least. A little awkward, no doubt. But I have heard that story, and I do believe it to be true. As sad as I am to have to admit that, but it seemed like it made sense at the moment. And the thing about it is that if you have Hogan cleared and able to wrestle in Oregon, you've helped make Oregon more profitable and more viable. And that's the thing about it. I think much too much was made of what's going to happen in Oregon. I mean, if you do great, how great is that? What's that mean? Is it worth the effort? Is it worth the controversy that you may endure? And, you know, I didn't know Oregon was that. I don't want to sound bad about Oregonians. I don't mean that at all. But things have changed there immensely in that respect. You know, WWE and AEW both have had success in that state. And I think that's pretty cool. But I think there's some, where there's a little smoke there, there's some fire.
You know, before we get that gets clickbaited everywhere, I just want to remind everybody, Howard Finkel lived in the Northeast, where the WWF was based, of course. Hulk Hogan did not. Hulk Hogan lived down in the Tampa area. So it does make sense that if the quote unquote office needed to get their top talent cleared, then as a matter of convenience, that may have been the reason they falsified it. I don't want people to assume that Hogan asked Finkel to do this because he felt like he had HIV. That's not real. I think it was a function of convenience. Like, hey, we got to send this in just so we can say we got Hogan and blah, blah, blah. Let's submit it. I don't think there's a cover up for a Hogan illness is what I'm trying to set the record
here. No. It was all about politics.
Yes.
He wasn't worried about, that he had HIV. Thank God. But it was a way to get back in the game. And they felt like at the time that that's what they had to do to re-enter the promotional scene. And certainly Hogan was the key catalyst.
Right.
And getting them back in the game. If you had Hogan on your roster and you could book him, you could run a couple of shows, big shows a year in Oregon, then have at it. And that's what you needed to do it to make it work. You needed Hogan to make it work.
Well, we got to make this Rena Mero lawsuit work too. It's in this era that it looks like it's going to be coming to a settlement. She originally sued for $140 million. On July 12th, it's noted in Hartford, Connecticut, that Titan does indeed own the name Sable. So that's business as usual. But there is going to be some sort of settlement outside of court on July 22nd. And we know that usually something like that means, well, they're never coming back. They're banned for life. But once again, as we admitted a few minutes ago, in wrestling, it's never say never. she's going to be back in the company just a handful of years later. Were you surprised that A, Rena got a settlement with the WWE, and B, that she came back after that?
The answer to both questions is no, I wasn't surprised. It's all a matter of putting an ass every 18 inches and selling product and merchandise. Pardon me. And she proved that along the way that she could sell merchandise, whether it be calendars or pictures or t-shirts or whatever it may be. She was very, very marketable. And Vince saw that and saddled that horse, in all due respect, and rode it to the pay window.
It was in this era, too, that we would hear a lot from Vince McMahon. He was making appearances like on TSN's Off the Record with Michael Landsberg. He's going to have a series of conversations here, and they're going to cover a lot of different topics. And these were not softball questions. I mean, TSN and Off the Record was really known for some of the harder hitting questions in wrestling. And they're going to take him to task about Bret Hart and about Owen Hart and a variety of things. Was there a planning process for appearances like this where we know that a lot of people are going to see this? It's going to go, for lack of a better word at the time, viral. It's going to get a lot of coverage. Everything he says is going to be dissected and all that. Do you think there's any sort of planning process like, okay, what will you say if he says this? What will you say if he says that? Like the sort of prep you would do before you go to court? Or is that not the case?
I think Mick Divitt was involved in a lot of that, Connie, as far as the role playing and the preparation. And he did and Jerry always did a great job. You know, I was shocked recently to find out that he was no longer with the company. Because allegedly he lost a lawsuit, with that MLW deal or something. I'm not sure. I didn't keep up with it. I'm not sure what all happened. It didn't pique my interest. I'm out of that loop, so I didn't waste my time on investing time and energy to something I had nothing to do with or not. So, but I think McDivitt had a hand in preparing Vince, much like he did for the trial. And McDivitt was a valuable asset. That's why I say I was so shocked. Someone told me that McDivitt no longer works with the WWE.
Yep. He's retired. McDivitt's completely retired.
I know. And I, knowing Cherry as I do, I just never thought he would step out of the game. No matter what. But, you know, he's in his 70s. He's made a lot of money, so he didn't have any financial needs, as best I know. I talk to Jerry still about once or twice a year, and it's just basically social calls. You know, Jerry's a Pittsburgh guy, and he was close to my family. And, of course, Jan being from Pittsburgh, that was another caveat. So he and I have always had a close relationship in that respect. I can guarantee you when I testified, I was extremely prepared, thanks to Jerry McDivitt.
One of the questions that Landsberg asked Vince is the question that a lot of us probably would have asked. With the benefit of hindsight, would you have made the same decision of continuing the show after Owen Hart's accident? And McMahon didn't answer the question, but he said that no disrespect was meant to anyone in continuing the show. And Landsberg said that many people, including the family, considered it disrespectful, and that if he himself had a member of his family that had died under those same circumstances, he would have considered it terribly disrespectful. Did you ever have that conversation with Vince? With the benefit of hindsight, does he regret continuing the show?
I don't think he had any regrets. He did what he thought was right, whether it was or it wasn't. Somebody had to make the decision. And he was sitting in that chair, the emperor's chair. And so I don't think he had any reservations at all. He may have privately, I don't know. But we never discussed it. And we discussed a lot of things over the years. That was not one of them.
One of the things that Landsberg follows up about on the whole Owen topic is, hey, you didn't announce to the live crowd in the building what had happened to Owen that night in Kansas City. And Vince said something along the lines of, I don't know if it's fair for the people to hear the announcement. They'd find out for sure later. And he even said that it didn't seem fair to announce it at the conclusion of the show. Listen, I don't think there's any right answer at that point. He made a call.
There isn't a right answer, Connie. There's not a hard and true right answer to this conundrum without question. And I think Vince simply did what he felt like in his gut was the right thing to do. And based on what we know about the whole scenario, how it eventually would play out, I don't know if there is a right answer. I just don't know. I don't know if there's a right answer. And we all, when he was the boss, he was the sergeant, he was the general, he was the emperor, he was everything. You just try to support that mindset. And that's what I did. I followed his lead, and it was uncomfortable at times, no doubt. But I don't know that there is a right answer to that whole situation. It was just terrible what occurred and what happened. And we had no precedent to go back and say, well, the last time this happened, we did this. There was no last time. It was the first time. It was the only time. So there's nothing, no precedent to go back and draw from. And when you don't have that, you're just starting with a clean slate. It's easy to make a mistake or be misjudged in this case, on how things went, how it should have gone, and what is the right answer. I don't know what the right answer is. And I was as close as anybody in the company, to that whole scenario. And I perceived, and I might be wrong, this may be an egocentric answer, but you know, I understood what was going on, and I also tried to think through it, and I never had the ability to come to a conclusion. Well, this is obvious. This is what we should do, and it was a controversial topic, to say the least, and that might be an understatement.
The thing I want to mention too is it's not like there was a precedent set where Vince knew like, hey, when this happens, we do this. There's no policies in place. There's no procedures in place. Something like this has never happened before. So I think a lot of us listening now, we would say, oh, well, I would have stopped the show. And I'd like to think now that I would have stopped the show. And I'm saying in that very moment, what do you do? It's a split second decision. You got to make that call and you got to live with it. He's bared the brunt of that the entire time. I do think I would have liked to have think that I would have stopped the show and announced that we've stopped the show and issue refunds and all that jazz. But in that very moment, you got to make a split decision call. You don't really have all the information and it's just kind of there. I think we all agree. It's just as regrettable as it possibly can be. One of the biggest, maybe the biggest tragedy in the history of professional wrestling.
Oh, I agree with that. And again, no right answer.
Right.
Pardon me. The fact that there was no precedent, there's no, boy, the last time this happened, here's what we did.
Right.
There's nothing to draw from.
That's right.
You're starting from scratch with a clean slate. And it got dirty much sooner than I wish it had. It was hard to, I've addressed that question and golly, I don't know, dozens of times.
Sure.
And I still don't have the answer. And I don't think I'm a dumb guy.
Well, but we're also able to be honest and say, boy, if that was my son, if that was my dad, boy, I'd want him to shut the show down. But in that specific moment, man, like, and I know Heavy is the head and Vince had to make the decision and it's his call and all that. I got to think with the benefit of hindsight, I think I would have, if I was Vince, I would regret continuing the show. But I know that you've got to deal with the hand that you were dealt. In real time, immediately.
It's like being an umpire.
Yes. Yes.
It's like balls and strikes, outs and safes, that type thing. It's you got to make a decision, not tomorrow, now. And he did that. I don't know how much guidance he got from his crew in the back. But you know, I know how I was communicated with. And I was told this story about, you know, Kevin Dunn coming in my headset and saying, we're going to make an announcement about Owen. Kevin Dunn thought that I knew what the update was already. I didn't. So it kind of fallen through the cracks as far as, well, we need to tell the announcement. We need to tell JR and the King what's going on. And somebody thought somebody else did it, and it didn't happen. So then all of a sudden I got about 15, 20 seconds to come up with something. And I didn't, we got through it the best we could, but hell, we had no time, no prep time to figure out the wording and the right answers or speak very deliberately or whatever. I mean, I just use common sense. But it was hard, man. It was a hard call that where there's no right or wrong scenario, in my opinion. And I'm not disagreeing with you. I think in hindsight, you can certainly make a case for the right thing to do was to stop the show.
Yes.
But that's not what happened.
Well, and to use your balls and strikes analogy, you know, the issue there, the only difference there is at the very moment that the accident happened, we didn't know the result immediately. Like,
right.
I mean, I was still optimistic as it was happening that I walk around my life optimistic. Oh, he'll be okay. They'll fix it. He'll be fine. This can't yeah. happen, because it's almost one of those, this can't happen to me type things. And so it's like, well, this won't really happen at a wrestling show. There's no way that could possibly be real,
yeah.
but damn it, it was. And,
very real,
super very sad situation, real. Less than ideal. The rest of this conversation with Michael Landsberg is talking about things like, hey, hypothetically, could you see yourself working again with Hulk Hogan? And Vince McMahon's quote, never say never. Right. Never say never in pro wrestling. Might be a theme today here on the show. He's also asked about Bischoff, and he says, I don't know what value Bischoff could offer. Of course, he's tongue-in-cheek shitting on Bischoff, and we know eventually he, too, is going to join the evil empire here. Meanwhile, you guys are dodging negative press everywhere you go. Lots of criticism about the Attitude Era. And I know that this is something where the company is trying to go public. Was there ever a consideration as we're getting ready to go public that all of this Attitude Era stuff was maybe too much? The crotch chops, the suckets, the middle fingers, the beer. Did you think that, I mean, you can't argue with the success of the television ratings. We just talked about at the top of the show, the most watched match in cable television, but that is appearing to the fans and the demo. Now we've got to do a bit of a paradigm shift, and we've got to appeal to investors. Was that a conscious discussion that you remember? Do we need to tone it down before we go public?
Yeah, of course. And we did, excuse me, we did tone it down to some degree. And I think we'd ridden that horse as far as it was able to go. How many crotch chops and suckets and all these things that you need? It worked in its time, but there was a time that needed to move on, go away, focus on the great talents we had and not so much on the, you know, their, how they were perceived and all that stuff, Connie. It was just, we knew we needed to take a departure at some point. The question was, what do we do? When do we do it? How do we change? What do we omit from our normal presentation? And I think it helped freshen up the product. And now look at their product. It's doing great, but they've made all these changes. Now they got a new road to travel today as we speak, and they're doing a great job in that regard. You can't deny or hide from the ticket selling success that and the new model of operation, shall we say, strategies. What they're doing now is working. And it's far from the Attitude Era.
Let's also mention this is a crazy time for the company, because not only are we trying to go public, and Vince is at least probably thinking about the XFL because he's going to launch that not too terribly long from now, but he's also closing a deal in mid-July to create a $25 million themed restaurant, more than 600 seats at the corner of Broadway and 43rd Street in Manhattan and Times Square. Right. Of course, we know this is going to go on to become the world, but the original idea is that the complex will have a retail store so you can buy WWF merch, an interactive arcade, and a theater, as well as a restaurant. We know in the end, this becomes a cautionary tale where we had some bad actors who were embezzling millions of dollars. But did you ever think this was a good idea, or did you think we were getting out of our wheelhouse, so to speak?
No, I thought it was a pretty good idea. You know, a restaurant on that location was a gold, could have been a gold mine, selling merch and having good food, having a place to convene, tourist type thing was, I thought, had a lot of potential. They just got the wrong guy to run it. And that guy got, I think he went to jail for embezzlement. I think embezzlement would be the right way to determine it. So, no, I never was against the world or the restaurant theme. You know, you got to have a place to sell your merch and they, that would have sufficed there. But, I don't think the idea was bad. I think the people that they had running it was a mistake. I don't know if not enough due diligence was done on their backgrounds and so forth. I can't remember the guy's name that was managing it. They got popped. But I'd never heard of him, which doesn't mean anything other than I hadn't heard of him. And why would I have heard from him or of him? So, no, I thought the idea, the general idea of having this facility in that location was solid but you got to have the right personnel to pull it off.
Hey, let's talk about some other names here that are going to be departing the company. We talked about Big Show coming in and Jericho coming in, but on their way out are Nicole Bass, Shannon Hall, Goldust, and Ryan Shamrock. Nicole Bass had said that, hey, she could actually earn more money doing apartment wrestling than she was making with the WWF. It's written in the Observer that perhaps the office was disappointed in her failure to improve in the ring. And there were some fans who felt like the dream match would be Nicole Bass versus Chyna, but the office knew, well, that could only hurt Chyna because Chyna's not bigger than Nicole Bass. So it might ruin some of the mystique of Chyna right. being this incredible Hulk woman.
But and Conrad, excuse me, the match quality
terrible
would have been horrible.
Yes,
it would have been terrible to force our fans to sit through that particular presentation. And I can assure you, from endless talks with Joni Chyna, she had no interest in working with Nicole Bass because Joni was the old school in that regard. She wanted to have good matches, and I think that's why she was so adamant about working with men, because she knew the match quality would be better. I remember talking to her about working with Ivory. Ivory was a much better worker, but it wasn't the attraction that Chyna was. And, it'd been a disaster. Train wreck. So train wreck might have been a compliment. So, I'm glad we didn't travel that road.
Yeah, I think everybody agrees. It would have done Chyna no favors. Chyna's a bona fide star at that point. It's right. just yep. not a good call. I do want to spend some time talking about Goldust, though, because he had been such a big part of the company. I mean, that character was revolutionary. He had incredible years in 95 and 96, and then the evolution of the character in 97. He turned the volume up on the weird in 1998. Then we tried the little religious thing for just a minute in 1999. But by now, here in July, he's no longer with the company. And it's written in the Observer that Terry Runnels, his soon-to-be ex-wife, they're in the process of divorce, she just signed a new deal. So the company clearly felt like she was more marketable than Goldust at that point.
Right.
With the benefit of hindsight, is that one you regret? Or was the real-life Dustin just not in a good place at the time?
I don't think he was in a great place. I think drugs and alcohol was part of his enemy. And she was marketable. There's no doubt about that. She had a great look. She was smart, and could help us in a lot of different ways. But he kind of shot himself in the feet, and not good. I think we could have let him go for a while and restructured his push and moved on. But that was not what Vince wanted to do. Once Vince is through with you, I can speak from experience. Once he's done with you, he's done with you.
Let's talk a little bit about the pay-per-view. Fully Loaded, we're finally here. And Meltzer would write, this was probably the best pro wrestling pay-per-view show in 3 months. It was the end of an era as Vince McMahon had to leave the company that his grandfather founded. Well, forgetting the stipulation, no doubt to be worked into a clever return of McMahon, it was largely an entertaining show with better than average wrestling, the expected great production, and strong storylines. So let's talk about the pre-show. In this era, we're still doing Sunday Night Heat. What'd you think of Sunday Night Heat as a program? I loved it as a pre-show, but did you like it on a weekly basis, or where did you land on Sunday Night Heat?
Nonplussed. I think it was a good tool to use to promote the pay-per-views to get people to tune in and buy. Didn't have a problem with that. But Sunday Night Heat, just as a brand name, didn't do a hell of a lot for me. Because all your best stuff is going to be on the pay-per-view, not on Sunday Night Heat. And fans are smart enough to figure that out. So as an infomercial, as a lead-in, I got it. But it wasn't something that I looked forward to thinking, oh, boy, this Sunday we're going to have Sunday Night Heat. It's going to be great. Because greatness is determined by the matches that you're displaying and featuring. And I wasn't a big fan of Sunday Night Heat, but it was, it all depended on the content and what we're presenting. So it hit and miss. It was a hit and miss type thing. And at the end, it kind of became I don't want to say a necessary evil, but it was like, okay, enough's enough. But I thought when it just came on, it was a good idea to feature what was happening that night that you could participate in if you push that right button and make it happen.
Let's talk a little bit about the pre-show here. On Heat, we've got Val Venus, the porn star, beating Joey Abs. Get a little interference from the Mean Street Posse. Then we've got the pimp, the Godfather, beating Meat. Everybody knows that he beat Meat. Before the match, this is a real story. That's on Sunday Night Heat on the WWF in 1999. Meat had relations with Terry Runnels, and he's spent. He's so physically exhausted, he can barely stand up. And in that weakened condition, he has to go out here and wrestle. So, of course, Godfather beats him. Buddy, what are we doing? Pimps in the first match, or porn stars in the first match, pimps in the second match. A guy who's too exhausted.
It's too much. It's overload. It's like one sensational storyline. If you got one, well, then two will make it that much better. And that's not always the case. So it's just too much.
It feels oversexed.
Yeah, too much of the same shit.
By the way, when Meat loses, Terry says he's not good at either one. Goodness gracious. Then we get a pretty important moment in WWE history, and I want to ask you about this. There's this shocking interview from Triple H. This is the one where he's on the couch. He's got the black leather hat backwards. He's talking to you, and he's cutting a serious promo here. And this is one of the better promos of his career. It's a coming out party of sorts. And he's talking about some worked shoot stuff, I suppose. He's crying about the 1996 King of the Ring tournament, saying he was supposed to win, but his friends did their curtain call at Madison Square Garden. He's the only one who got punished. He's blaming you and management for holding him down. I like this promo and this piece of business. What can you tell us about this really important promo in the history of the Triple H character?
Well, I think that he was telling the truth. I think that he was held back. I think people, you know, Vince and company, the guys surrounding Vince were not sure of how successful the Triple H heel character was going to be. Some of us, and I include myself in that, some of us had no reservations because we knew that he was very likely going to be our next big star. And pro wrestling is driven so much by its heels and villains that you always got to have those positions strong and filled. And I thought that Paul Levesque was going to be the next big thing. And lo and behold, he was.
I saw something the other day that jumped off the page to me. If Silva can, our producer, can throw that photo back up there of Triple H on the couch with you. Someone said online recently that this was Triple H basically stealing, maybe borrowing is a better word, the franchise persona from Shane Douglas in ECW. And I'm not suggesting that you used to watch ECW television on the regular in 97, 98, 99, but the hair, the promo, the delivery style, the whole thing. I've seen people online say that, boy, Triple H was heavily influenced in this era by the franchise character that Shane Douglas presented in ECW. Did you ever consider that? Have you ever thought of that or heard of that crossover?
I have heard about it vaguely, Conrad, but I'm not sure. So how accurate that assessment is. I just thought it was a no brainer. He was the next great heel. And that fact was proved out. He had an amazing run as that amazing character. And he drew a lot of money for WWE. He established himself as a main player. So I never picked up on the connectivity between Triple H and Shane Douglas. I can see how a point could be made, certainly, but I don't know. I just, that never really struck me as an issue, as a point of emphasis.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like I take personal issue with it. I love the franchise character. I loved what Triple H became and did, but I never even thought about the comparison or saw the similarities until it was pointed out. And then I was like, okay, I could see that influence. I mean, we know once Triple H becomes a top guy, he certainly leaned into Harley Race. I mean, he grew the mutton chops. He wore the purple. The whole presentation was very Harley Race at times. And of course, he was heavily influenced by Ric Flair as well, but I just never even considered the Shane Douglas potential there.
Me neither. I can see how the point could be made. And quite honestly, I can see how that point could be made, but it never jumped out at me that, oh, this, that he's channeling Shane Douglas in his character. I never saw that.
Well, this is the shoot interview, if you will, where he first calls himself The Game. What'd you think of the name The Game?
Loved it. I thought it was great. And why I loved it, because it worked. It worked, Conrad. And that name stuck with him. It was a cool name. It wasn't overly gimmicky. I loved it. I thought it was great. He's such a student of the game, which we're seeing today in his leadership role in WWE.
Absolutely.
We're seeing how smart he really is and great vision. But I never had that issue. I never put the two together. Shane Douglas and Triple H. I never put those two together. Like you're saying, you didn't either.
No, it never crossed my mind. But when it was pointed out, I thought, okay, I could see why people would think that. And I'm not saying that he did. I'm just saying I never even considered the similarities until then.
Me neither.
I want to ask you about the name, The Game. There's a rumor that allegedly The Game was going to be a name and a nickname and a persona that Owen Hart might have used. I'd never heard that until we started doing research for this. And I guess there was a suggestion that once upon a time, that was an idea for Owen Hart. Do you remember ever hearing that?
No.
Yeah.
Never did. I use that analogy many times in commentary, the game, and then it became real. You know, sometimes when you say something often enough with a significant frequency, they become reality. And I think that's the case with this situation, is that Triple H and the game name became a reality. And one of the reasons that stuff works is because it worked. It just did. It worked. And, you know, he lived up to his name. And I don't know what I'd do to go back and retrace those steps of Triple H and the game name and his persona and things of that nature. It just all seemed to fit to me and fit really well.
We should at least draw the comparison. And I know that nothing is really going to compare to the run that Stone Cold Steve Austin had. But I do think there are times and moments and maybe specifically promos that become a catalyst, a turning point, a launching point. And I almost feel like this promo where he's calling himself the game here, Triple H, this is like his Austin 316 promo. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It clicked, it stuck, and people bought into it. And so, yeah, I can see your point there very, very clearly.
I'm excited for us to talk a little bit about the pay-per-view, because this is all on the pre-show, what we're talking about so far. We haven't even gotten to the actual pay-per-view. There's one more match on the pre-show. It's Christian over Viscera in 2:43. Gangrel's going to be here. There's going to be an interview. Undertaker is going to attack Austin, who's going to be bleeding. So he's bleeding in advance of their first blood match. So that's how we go off the air in the pre-show. We know they're going to be in the main event in a first blood match. And before the doggone show even starts, Austin's already bleeding. This is fun stuff. This is how you sell some last minute pay-per-views, is it not?
That's it. That's the best pre-game illustration that I could give you. That one shot there that I don't know what the hell I was doing back there, but before this, there was a shot. I'm wearing all black. I think I'm channeling my inner Johnny Cash, I guess. But that's the way you sell them. You give an illustration of what's still to come. There I am. What a handsome young fat guy. that was a great pre-show angle. That's when you take advantage of your pre-show. That's how that works. And that worked very good to me.
Let's talk about the actual pay-per-view. Let's jump right into it. Jeff Jarrett is going to open the show against Edge, and he's going to pin Edge to win the Intercontinental Championship. Edge had won the title the night before in Toronto. And in real life, Ken Shamrock's flight arrived late. So Edge, who had worked the opener already, was put in as a substitute. And they decided to have him beat Jeff Jarrett since he's from the outskirts of Toronto. So it's building him up for the local market. It's pretty rare in this time where we would do title changes on house shows. But Edge was the Intercontinental Champion here for one day before dropping it to Jeff Jarrett in 13:22. Is there a best practice for when you have someone like Ken Shamrock, who you've mentioned before, had some reliability problems? When that happens, I know that Bruce has taught us over on Something to Wrestle, if you can't deliver what was advertised, the replacement always has to be better.
Correct.
The idea here is let's get the local guy in there and let's have him do the unthinkable. Let him win the belt with no television cameras around. Is that the strategy?
Yeah, pretty much. Anything can happen. You don't want to miss a moment. You know, check this out. You never know what's going to occur. And that was a tough situation. It was great that Jarrett was amenable to working with Edge on his second go round in that night. It's a compliment to Edge that he was able to pull it off and they had a good match. You know, I've been critical pardon me, of Jeff Jarrett at times, probably my own curse. But that whole thing, because of their experience and their dedication and their product knowledge, they both understood their role, and, became good television.
It was good television. He's with Deborah here. She's looking as only she can look, as Ric Flair would say. And he's going to win the world title back, or the Intercontinental title back, from Edge here in the opener. Pretty good match. 3 stars. They go 13 minutes and 22 seconds. After the match, Austin's going to hit the ring and give Jeff Jarrett a stunner, because why not? Let's talk about the next match. We've got Farouk and Bradshaw here. They're going to regain the WWF tag team titles from the Hardy Boys. They're actually teaming with Michael Hayes here. So it becomes a 2-on-3 affair. They go 9 minutes and 32 seconds. I know we all think the world of the APA. Of course, the Hardys are on their way up the cards. They're going to be bona fide stars. I mean, the match they're going to have in a couple of months is going to make them legends in the WWE. Of course, I'm talking about No Mercy 99 in October. But this moment here, where they're teaming with Michael Hayes on a pay-per-view, talk to me about the type of ribbing that Michael Hayes was getting from you guys in their office about him being in the ring on pay-per-view in 1999 with these young bucks known as the Hardy Boys.
We couldn't resist it.
Yes.
It was too easy. It's too easy, Connie. And Michael was a good sport and all that stuff. And the bottom line is, after a hiatus of months and months, he was back on television, and he hadn't forgotten a thing. He was very good. Michael Hayes has a great wrestling mind. And the only issue there was that, you know, his body was only going to allow him to do so much, so often. And I was skeptical of Michael being back in the ring at that point in time of his career, but I applauded us trying to make it work. And I know that it made Michael happy to get back in the game.
Let's talk a little bit about Michael Hayes for a minute, because I don't think enough people recognize or realize this. This is technically his last match. Now, I know he's going to have a non-televised event, an independent event in 2000 for the Hardy Boys versus the Fabulous Freebirds, which will be Michael Hayes and Terry Gordy. That's not televised, but that's technically his last real match. But this is the last one that we see on a national stage outside of that gimmick battle royal that he did at WrestleMania 17.
All right.
And what's interesting is that even as you're describing Michael Hayes getting back in the ring, there's this question about, well, can his body hold up and blah, blah, blah. Right. My man's 40 years old here.
Yeah.
I just find it interesting how our perception of age in wrestling continues to evolve and change. Like, years prior to 1999, you had people wrestling in their 50s and 60s. And now we see a lot of the main eventers that we see on television week in, week out, are in their 50s. Hell, Sting was in his 60s, and he had a phenomenal match earlier this year. Time is kind of a funny thing in that regard, is it not?
Yeah, and it's too much is made of age. If you can still perform at the acceptable level, age should have nothing to do with anything. Did you have a good outing? Did you entertain the fans? Did you tell a good story? Did you take good crisp bumps, but only on a limited basis? They meant more. Then there you go. But I was happy for Michael, because Michael's a natural born performer, and I was very happy he got his opportunity to get another hug, so shall we say, in a WWF or WWE ring, and it was good. I thought it was always decent television. He was too smart. He didn't put himself into his position, Conrad, that made it look awkward or a step off or what have you. He's just one of the great performers of all times, Michael Hayes.
Next up, we've got D'Lo Brown winning the European title from Midian. They go 7 minutes and 11 seconds. We haven't spent a lot of time talking about it, but without the British Bulldog there, does the European title make much sense? I mean, it just felt
not really, yeah. not really. not really. It was, it added a title match to your card. Was the title viable and hot and smoldering hot? Not really. Bulldog was, it was kind of built for Bulldog, around Bulldog, and not for Midian and D'Lo. And I like both those guys a lot. They were good locker room guys. They worked hard. I was glad to have them on our team. But the European title was, it kind of ran its course.
Yeah, when it was for British Bulldog, it made sense. If it was on William Regal, I could get behind it. But when it's D'Lo and Midian, it's like, what are we doing? This doesn't feel authentic, if that makes sense.
No, it does make sense, and you're right. It didn't feel authentic. It didn't feel fresh. It didn't feel new. So, but I was glad both those guys got a payday. I knew that their match would be good, probably not great, but good, solid. And I think that they fulfilled that scenario. But the European title had seen its best days.
Let's talk a little bit about the next match here. It's Big Boss Man and Al Snow, for the hardcore title. This has been pretty much the same match that we see on every pay-per-view. There's lots of, weapons and brawling and things like that. And we were seeing this pretty consistently in this era. Maybe it's the ECW influence. What'd you think of the hardcore title and, you know, them brawling all over the arena and in the backstage area? Was it just par for the course at the time? Did you feel like it was passe, or were you a fan of this?
I think that ship had sailed a little before we set it free. Enough's enough. And, both those guys are excellent workers. They did a good job. Boss Man was kind of getting back in the groove of being utilized in a significant level. And Al is very underrated. One of the better, one of the more underrated performers that we had on our roster. So, I think it ran its course. You can only hit somebody with a frying pan or a trash can lid or whatever so many times before it starts losing its potency. So, it ain't like Blue Chew. It's not that. Enough's enough. And but I was glad those guys got a chance to dance on a big stage. They're both veterans. They deserve the opportunity to perform on that level. And even though the gimmick was a little bit worn, those guys worked their ass off to make it as good as they could.
Let's, I love the work at the time. I can say as a fan who was a big fan of ECW at the time, I could see this was, hey, we're going to try to pacify that interest, but I still enjoyed it. It was different. It felt like a break, but maybe too much of it at times was a little silly.
I agree.
Next up, we've got Big Show and Kane. They're going to go 8 minutes and 13 seconds. Bob Holly was a riot as a special ref doing the Barney Fife to Big Show's Andy Griffith routine. That's the way Dave Meltzer reported it here. What'd you think of the idea of putting these two big giants together? This feels a little old school. Like I, as a fan, have grown to realize that I enjoy the David versus Goliath story inside of a match. I want a big man and a little man. I think they can do fun stuff together. But on paper, when you see these old posters from yesteryear, two big giants, boy, that does look appealing. What would you think of the idea of pitting giants together? And what do you think of this particular presentation of Kane and Big Show?
Well, I thought the match was a little long. Both attraction guys, 2 7-footers. You know, 300 pounds each or more. I thought it was challenging for those guys. And I think that we gave them too much time to quote unquote fill. And it didn't come off good at the end. And I love both those guys. I signed both guys. I recruited both guys. I really, have great respect for Big Show and for Kane. So Kane came a long ways. The first time I saw him in Smoky Mountain Wrestling, where he became as a Hall of Famer. So, and I look forward to seeing Big Show this weekend, you know, in Ohio.
You're going to see him this weekend. Of course, it's going down Friday, tomorrow, August 2nd, 5 to 7 p.m. at All-Star Sports Gallery in the Hartville Marketplace. And it's a who's who of pro wrestlers that are there. The Big Show's there. Jerry Lawler's there. Jim Ross, Kurt Angle, The Godfather, Bushwhacker Luke, Tito Santana, Kelly Kelly, Summer Rae, Emma, Sabu, Francine, Shane Douglas, The Sandman, Chavo Guerrero. It's a who's who, and it's all happening tomorrow, August 2nd, 5 to 7 p.m. All your information on how you can buy tickets and pre-sales right now at primetime12.com. That's primetime12.com. This match here is not widely regarded in a positive manner on the Torch or the Observer. It gets a negative star, and there's lots of interference at the end. X-Pac's going to do a run in and kick Bob Holly, who's our special guest referee. So the Undertaker comes out, choke slams X-Pac. Taker and Show are going to join forces and lay out Kane. Fans are chanting for Austin, but they're going to do the gimmick backstage. Whereas Taker comes through the curtain, Austin jumps him and he's bleeding. So now both guys are bloody ahead of their first blood match, which is going to be a little crazy in our main event a little later. And this actually sets up Undertaker and Big Show against Kane and X-Pac in the future. Ken Shamrock is going to beat Steve Blackman in a circle of cars. I don't know what we're doing here, but that's what we got. We're in the backstage area. We got cars in a circle. The headlights are on. We saw this recreated a few years ago in AEW, but this is the first time I remember seeing something like this with guys breaking car windows and windshields. It feels awfully dangerous. What'd you think of this, Ken Shamrock and Steve Blackman? I guess you'd call it a parking lot fight.
Well, you're asking guys to take bumps on concrete and on cars and things like that. There's only so much that they can do. And this is another example of where I thought that this match may have lasted too long. There's only so much you can do. And then you start becoming repetitive. And, you know, I understood the concept and all that stuff, but I probably thought it was a little, you know, I don't know. I lost interest in it, before I should have.
We got to talk about the next match here. It's Road Dogg and X-Pac beating China and Mr. Ass. And what we're doing here is we're having a match for the rights to the name DX. There's no argument that DX, this crew we're looking at here, is one of the most over outfits in the history of the promotion, a merchandise juggernaut. And China's actually working a lot here, and these guys are making her look pretty good.
Yeah.
They go 11 minutes and 44 seconds. Road Dogg and X-Pac get the win. Road Dogg pins Mr. Ass with the pump handle slam, 2.25 stars. So the prior month at King of the Ring, that's where we would see Billy Gunn become King of the Ring. And a month later, he's putting Road Dogg, his old tag team partner, over. I like that we're trying to keep everybody in DX strong here, Jim.
Yeah, me too. And those guys are all main eventers. You know, y'all always knew the match was going to be strong. It's going to be solid. It's going to be logical. And, so I had no issues with it whatsoever. 4 great stars, you know, Road Dogg's terribly, underrated, still is in my view, great mind. And, of course, Joni was in where she wanted to be all along. She's in the ring wrestling men, and she did a great job. I was spending a lot of time with her from a talent relations standpoint. And she was Joni was a delicate person. She had issues, insecurity issues, insecure, you know, that type thing. But she was living her dream of being in a pay-per-view. A worldwide pay-per-view and wrestling with men. That's what she always wanted to do. So, but it seemed like even then she wasn't totally happy. And that is frustrating for an administrator like myself at that time. What do we have to do to make you happy? It's got to be more than just the money, because that's kind of what broke up the band, is that she thought she was, you know, she told me many times she was worth more or as much as Stone Cold. And at that point in time in the wrestling business, nobody was as important as Stone Cold, including China. Was she a star? Yeah. And was she going to make a lot of money? Without a doubt. And she did make a lot of money. She was a 7-figure player, making over $1 million a year. And she just thought that it was second thought. Like, well, of course I'm worth as much as Stone Cold is. And, you know, many of us had a difference of opinion on that one.
Next up, it's Hunter Hearst Helmsley and The Rock. This is going to be a big time match. It's a strap match. I think most of us remember their incredible ladder match from the year prior. It was SummerSlam 1998, Madison Square Garden. And now it's Triple H's turn. Triple H is going to pin The Rock to earn a title shot in this strap match. They go 19 minutes and 21 seconds. The Rock does another incredible interview before the match. And this is a great match where Triple H is even more aggressive than normal, trying to get himself over as a real world title contender. And the fans are into it, including a part where Rock actually takes a camera from a fan, takes a photo of Triple H, and gives the camera back. Just hilarious, fun stuff.
Yeah. Dwayne was always great at the improv. Instincts, timing, he had it all. And let's not take anything away from Triple H. He came to play that night. He was the game, and the game was on.
Eventually, Triple H is going to hit a low blow. He's going to start choking The Rock with the strap. Rock's going to come back and lay the smack down on him. This brings Mr. Ass down. He's going to hit The Rock with a club. Rock kicks out, and there's a huge pop for that. Rock's making his comeback with a low blow and a people's elbow, but Billy Gunn is going to pull Rock off of Triple H. Rock's going to give Billy Gunn the Rock Bottom, and this allowed Triple H to hit the pedigree on The Rock for the pin, 3.25 stars. So we're setting up a feud here with Billy Gunn and The Rock, but we're also setting up Triple H for a title shot at SummerSlam. What'd you think of that storyline? A way to get Rock doing something, but also advance this game storyline with Triple H.
I liked it. I liked it, Connie. I thought it was spot on. And the big boys came to play. If there ever was a description of being in the game or being in the moment, we got it here in this one. It was just a outstanding booking, and the talents rose to the occasion without question.
Let's talk a little bit about the main event, because this is a first blood match where we saw on the same show both guys bleeding before they got in the ring. It's the WWF Championship First Blood End of an Era match. Austin versus The Undertaker for the WWF title. Vince McMahon is out to do commentary. Did you enjoy doing commentary with Vince? I mean, I know how much you enjoyed doing it with Lawler, and I know that we've read in your book and heard before that, boy, he could be brutal producing you in your headsets, but when he's at your elbow on the show at the desk, is that
much better?
Okay.
Much better.
Yeah.
Because he's there. Eye contact was, you could create eye contact. It improved the communication of what you were doing. It's a lot better for him to be sitting at ringside than to be sitting in my headset. And he was, because Vince is a good announcer. He knew how to play his role, and he had vision. He knew what he wanted to say, and he knew what he wanted to be, how things should be perceived. Vince being at ringside added an element that we previously had not had in that environment. And I thought it worked out really well.
It's interesting, because I want to ask you about, if Silva can show that photo of the three of you at the desk again. You see Jerry Lawler in the middle, and I've never done this, so I don't know. But is the guy in the middle directing traffic? I'm saying in a 3-announce booth. Is I'm wondering, is one guy tapping another guy on a leg? I mean, because you don't want everybody step on each other and talk over each other. And I know I'm getting way in the weeds on being an announcer here with you, but I don't think people talk about this enough. But you and I even struggle at times because we're not in the same room where right. I'll start talking and you will, or vice versa. And that's not very professional, and we're doing our best, but we're separated. But if you and I were together, we could just tap each other on the knee and we would know, like, okay, your turn, okay, my turn, or whatever, if we're in person like that. Does the person who sits in the middle, are they the traffic cop, for lack of a better word?
Not really.
Okay.
I was always a traffic cop.
Okay.
And Jerry did his thing, and Vince was doing his thing. It was my job to stay out of their way, to try to embellish what they're saying, what they're doing, to get them over, to get what they were talking about over. And then, as I've said this many times, somebody's got to be there to connect the dots. So if Vince had a thought that I felt like needed to be followed up on, then that's what I did, and bring it back to him. Or same thing with Lawler. Lawler normally was a more comedic, one-line type guy. But it seemed to, having Vince at ringside, I thought worked pretty well. Better than the headset. Much better. It's a whole different ball game. Much better than the headset.
Let's talk about the match. We got a heck of a match here that's going to go 3 3/4 stars. Austin's going to make a comeback at the end, and he's going to go to shake Vince's hand and give him another stunner, and the show goes off the air. It's a fun match. Triple H is running in. Everybody's beating on each other. They've all got tape on their head from where they were bleeding before. Shane McMahon is here. But as long as Austin's getting his hand raised and he's the world champ and Vince is taking a stunner, we're sending fans home happy. We don't have to overthink this formula, right?
No, hell no. Don't overthink it. Give the fans what they wanted. They wanted to see Austin as a champion. They want to see Austin win. And we gave them that. And of course, then the inevitable, Austin gives a stunner to Vince, and people love that. I thought we checked all of our boxes in that match.
There's no doubt we did. It's a fun match. I would encourage you to go out of your way to see it. As I said, it gets 3 3/4 stars. It's heavy on story. But just seeing Austin and Vince do their thing again here is super fun.
Never got old, Conrad. It just never got old. Their chemistry was just amazing. It was obvious that what the fans wanted. And if you're a smart marketer, a smart promoter, you seek out those solutions of what does the audience want. Well, the audience wanted to see Austin and McMahon has some physical interaction, and we provided that. It was good stuff. And I thought Austin and Taker, even though I mentioned earlier, their chemistry was so-so. Based on what they both have said, it was tough in that regard. I'm sitting there watching with Lawler, and Austin and Taker, they had blood, they had violence, they had intrigue, all that stuff. So it seemed to work out pretty damn well.
Of course, Austin's win here is supposed to guarantee that Vince McMahon will never appear on WWF television again. And that lasts, of course, for a few months. Never say never. But do you think at that point it was time to give the Mr. McMahon character a rest? We had had so much for so long at that point. Is this one of those, how can I miss you if you don't go away type circumstances with Vince on camera?
Might be. That's a good point. Might be, Conrad. I think the character needed to be freshened up. We tried to do that. But the fans, it was hard to say that the fans got overloaded with McMahon and Austin. It was the greatest rivalry, the greatest, duo rivalry that I think we ever had. So it's hard to say, well, we're not going to do that anymore. Yeah, but it's working. People love it. And at some point, you got to put a bow on it. And that's what we did. We might have put a bow on it too prematurely too. That's an arguable point.
Well, the next night of professional wrestling is huge. Of course, this is a Sunday night pay-per-view, so we're going to be back-to-back with the Monday Night Wars. We're going to talk about that when we cover SummerSlam 99 in the coming weeks. But overall, I thought this was a pretty good show. What would you rate Fully Loaded 99? I give it a thumbs up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No doubt. No doubt I gave it a thumbs up. I would agree with you. But I thought the whole show was pretty strong. It was overbooked. We had too much. We had titles that were cold, that didn't help the cause. So, but other than that, I thought it was a strong pay-per-view. Look, they come to see the main event. And in that main event, we gave them blood. We gave them violence. We gave them all this stuff. And so I don't know how we could not have checked every box that the hardcore fan, which we were catering to, at that point in time, would not like.
We got to talk about the next night. We'll do that on SummerSlam 99. But before we do, we've got some great questions. And this one, I think, is interesting. I hadn't really considered it. The Fig Game Hunt 6946 over on YouTube says, at this time, was it always the plan to elevate Triple H over the summer of 99? Or was there potential that would have been more of a slower burn if it were not for injuries to Stone Cold? This is one of my favorite times as a wrestling fan. I was 14 and looking forward to every single week. Now, we know by November, and we're only in July here, so we're a few months away, but not terribly far away. Austin's going to decide, hey, man, I don't want to, but I got to go get surgery. I'm going to have to step away for a bit. So we do need to make new stars. Do you think, just like in sports, injuries create opportunities on the depth chart, and that is what fast tracks Triple H?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was, we were kind of backed into a corner. Triple H was younger, healthier. He had earned his stripes, shall we say, and he did a great job. But I think that injuries create opportunities if it's done correctly. And this one was done correctly.
Brent Barnett Hunting says, Jim, one thing I remember from this match is Shane taking a brutal chair shot from Austin. How did Vince feel about the bumps Shane put himself through?
Never heard you comment on it. Hit him harder, maybe. Vince didn't protect Shane, and Shane sure as hell paid his dues, man. He took a lot of abuse and was used as a key element in the build. Key element in the finishes. So I never heard Shane complain one time about something being too stiff, too rough. Tough kid, boy. And of course he had his dad's legacy to live up to, and that seemed to go right along with the territory. Shane had a lot to prove. He was the owner's son, but nobody showed him I don't know what the word I'm looking for, but nobody showed him any kindness. He got the shit beat out of him more often than not.
I want to ask you about something, and maybe I shouldn't, but there's been much ado made about the show that happened, as folks are listening, 8 days ago in Nashville, Blood and Guts, the main event. It was the Elite versus Team AEW, and Mark Briscoe delivered a chair shot to Jack Perry. That boy spun up the internet and got everybody hot and bothered. I know you weren't there that night, but I also know that there are people who work behind the scenes for AEW. WWE used to have a guy who handled magic. Richie Posner was the guy's name. I'm not going to say the fellow's name here, but I know that AEW has a person who handles that in a similar fashion. Good guy. But there's been a lot made about that chair shot. And on the one hand, understand when we get concerned about the long-term health of the performers. But at the same time, I got to trust that these performers and the company are taking calculated risks, including setting a guy on fire, putting a mouthful of thumbtacks in, taking bumps, off ladders, through panes of glass, on the edge of the ring, power bombs, things like this. But people seemingly lost their mind about this chair shot, where I know a little bit of magic was involved. But the idea that we have to come out and defend that and discuss it feels weird to me. The name of the damn show is Blood and Guts. If you don't want to see right. simulated violence, don't watch a show called Blood and Guts. What'd you think of the chair shot? And what do you think of chair shots? If they believe they're done safely, can they be used sporadically like blood? Because once upon a time, we're saying no more blood, no more chair shots. We're seeing a little bit more of both now, but people are saying use sparingly, in moderation, and as safely as we can. You can make a calculated risk and a decision. What say you?
Still got to be careful with it. It's got to be, you got to be very judicious of how often it's used and where it's used, so forth. You know, I don't know that our man, Mr. Dudley has, I don't know if he knows any other way of doing it. That was an ECW chair shot.
Yeah.
And he came from downtown with it, man, and it resonated off another man's brain. So I can understand people's concern, and by and large, I agree with them. You know, that shot could have been on the back of the head, the upper back, shoulder blade area, but still, man, it resonated right off the man's head, and I was uncomfortable with it, to be honest with you. But I understand why it was done. I understand the environment that we were in on that show. When I saw it, watching it here at home, I was mildly shocked that it came from such velocity and harmful intent. And thank God I think they only used it once, if I remember correctly. So it was it's tough, man. It's how far do you go? What's too much? What's not enough? I would just suggest that there are ways to get the same violence without scrambling a guy's brains.
Let's do a few more questions here. Bobby wants to know, was anyone in the front office aware of what was going on in Turner with regards to the AOL Time Warner merger and the effects it was having on the WCW product? I know you're watching the show, you're seeing what their business is, you're recruiting talent to come over, but do you have any idea what the corporate chaos is like on the WCW side of things at this point?
Most of them in the corporate side just didn't want to get that involved.
Yep.
They just didn't want to get that involved. They didn't know what was safe and what wasn't safe. And if it's not safe, why are we doing it? All that stuff. So it was an interesting quandary, but you got administrators that really don't understand the product as much as they like to let on that they do. So, I'm on the page of caution. There's got to be something else we can do. I'm not big on all the thumbtack stuff and putting stuff in their mouth and all this. You know, you're a swallow away from disaster. You don't want to be swallowing a mouthful of thumbtacks, for God's sakes. And how much did it add to the match? How viable was it to the whole process? I argue the fact that sometimes that stuff is overrated.
Let's mention that next week we've got a very special episode coming up. I'm pretty excited to talk about this. Pumped is the right word. We're going to talk about when Vince was acquitted from all charges brought on him by the federal government and how your time in the WWF comes to an end again. That's what we'll be doing next week here on the program. We'd love to have your interactions and your questions. You can find us at the place you can find all things JR, grillingjr.com. Hit the subscribe button, turn on the notifications bell. You'll know the next time we go live. We've got all of our episodes there and lots of new clips all the time at grillingjr.com. Totally free. I also want to mention that you get these shows early and ad-free over at adfreeshows.com. We have got an incredible lineup of bonus content, including series you can't find anywhere else, including the brand new series we just debuted called Potting Ain't Easy. You're going to get to visit and hang out with the Godfather every single month at adfreeshows.com. You get to do that with Sam Adonis for what we call Learning Lucha. He's one of the top stars south of the border, but the real-life brother of Corey Graves, the son of a promoter from the Pittsburgh area, who better to explain to us what was about Lucha Libre and what is about Lucha Libre. So if you're looking to learn a little more about maybe a side of wrestling you didn't know, learning lucha is for you. Tullyvision is where Tully Blanchard and I take a look at some of his fantastic matches and moments through his career and talk about the way wrestling used to be. So if you're a big nostalgia fan, I think you'll dig Tullyvision, and you'll probably enjoy the book where David Crockett and I sit down every month and go page by page, show by show, day by day through his brother's red books, the excellent penmanship of J.J. Dillon, the genius mind of Dusty Rhodes. How did Jim Crockett Promotions and the NWA run their business through the year 1986? That's what we're marching through. All of 85 is in the archives. Speaking of the archives, there's a ton of great episodes with Mike Chioda and Nick Patrick. They were the third man in the ring for some of the most memorable moments in wrestling history. And you get to hear their inside knowledge that they've never shared before. These guys aren't running around writing a bunch of books or doing a bunch of shoot interviews. So the only place to hear their stories is at adfreeshows.com. And the same goes for Lex Luger. There's an interactive show we do every month with Lex where you can be on camera with Lex Luger asking your questions on Lex Expressed. There's more than 100,000 hours of bonus content right now at adfreeshows.com. And appreciate everybody joining and hanging out with us live today. We had a live studio audience. And as a matter of fact, I actually have a clip of a new piece of bonus content we just recently did. We do a series over there that's been pretty critically acclaimed, Jim, called The False Finish, where we take a look at some guys' careers who maybe ended abruptly, and we sort of scratch our head about how they got to the top of the mountain and then how quickly it ended and now what they're up to these days. Most recently, we visited with Brian Clark on our False Finish series. You may remember him as Adam Bomb in the WWF or over in WCW, and for a cup of coffee in the WWE, Chronic. Let's take a listen. Were you on a per deal basis? Was this just a favor and a tryout? I mean, it's so random to see a television show, a house show, a pay-per-view done.
Yeah. We signed a full 1-year contract, guaranteed money. Guaranteed.
And they honored the contract and you sat at home and got paid?
Yep. Sure did. But that's why I didn't understand everything that was going on. I mean, yeah, we got paid and everything, but as far as career wise, it didn't help us. But yeah, I was guaranteed one solid year. Yeah.
Are you in any sort of regular communication? I mean, after that September pay-per-view, you're just sitting home?
Pretty much. Yeah.
How crazy is that? Chronic comes to the WWE, one house show, one TV, one pay-per-view, sent home. It's a crazy conversation. Get the whole thing at adfreeshows.com. We've done this False Finish series in the past with Muhammad Hussain, with Midian, with Glacier, with TNA's Chris Harris, and so many more. It's all available for you now at adfreeshows.com. There's a lot of value at adfreeshows.com, isn't there, Jim?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of stuff that you would never dream that you would hear. And in a different generation, you just never expected to hear this much honesty. Vince didn't like Chronic. And he thought he did until he saw him. And I don't know if that's fair. I don't think probably isn't fair. But they got paid everything that they were promised to be paid. They got significant time off and making a good amount of money, no doubt. So, that just didn't work out well. I felt bad for those guys. Brian's a good guy, but he was hungry. He wanted more, and like a lot of the guys, he wanted more. He wanted to live his dream. And how can you get pissed off at somebody for wanting to live their dream? I can't. I really can't. So, I wish things had worked out better for those dudes, because they were, like I said, they looked good. They moved around well. They just were impressive in a lot of ways, but there was something there, Conrad, that Vince just did not see and was not willing to try.
Well, we hope that you'll give us a try over at jrsbbq.com. They've got something for everybody. You can get action figures and trading cards and even books. But my favorite reason to go to jrsbbq.com is the all-purpose seasoning. I fired up a brisket this past weekend and then followed it up with some chicken. The all-purpose seasoning was on both of those pieces of business. And business is about to pick up when you try it on your poultry or your beef or your protein of any sort. I've got a friend of mine who eats it on their eggs every single morning. You're going to love it at JRsBBQ.com. They got two types of barbecue sauce. They've even got a hot sauce, a chipotle ketchup, a main event mustard. But maybe it's all about the book. Business is about to pick up. Check it out right now at JRsBBQ.com. And if you're in the Ohio area, man, what are you waiting for? Jump in your car. Go see JR tomorrow, August 2nd from 5 to 7 p.m. He's going to be there in Hartville. All the information is available now at primetime12.com. That's primetime12.com. Jim, I had a lot of fun talking about the good old days of professional wrestling with you today. And
me too.
Talking about some of the more current things with the Jack Perry chair shot and the news that Shane McMahon did meet with Tony Khan. And it turns out, unlike that asshole on Twitter believes, you're not senile, by God. Never say never in pro wrestling.
Well, I might be a little senile, Conrad. I have my moments, but I appreciate that. And I appreciate everybody's support. You know, we don't do this show to get everybody to agree with us.
No.
We do the show because we're interested in a certain topic or a certain time period, and we move on from there. So we don't expect, Conrad, nor I expect to make believers out of everybody. It's just we have our philosophies and we're true to them. So, but it's fun. That's one of the great things about doing these appearances. You get a lot of these questions you get at your autograph table. And I love that. It just keeps the thing moving along and it's entertaining, informative. So it's all good stuff. So the great state of Ohio will be, having a lot of stars and we'll have a lot of fun, no doubt. 5 to 7 p.m., ladies and gentlemen. So you're in that area and you get off work, you get out of school, drop by and say hi.
You're going to love it. Go see JR in person. If you haven't already, you need to. Jim's a legend, and I'm glad he's making time to do this show with us every week. I'm glad he's on the road making appearances, and I'm glad that you can hear him on AEW. If you haven't already, check out the schedule when AEW is coming to your town at AEWTIX.com. We got our fingers crossed that JR is going to be calling some fun matches at All In across the pond. It's going to be a heck of a show, and you don't want to miss it. You can always support AEW and JR by checking out the AEW product at AEWTIX.com. Jim, as you and I are recording, it's a Wednesday, and tonight we're supposed to hear what Bryan Danielson has to say after a pretty impressive little piece of business backstage with Jeff Jarrett last week. And I guess Bryan has to make a decision. Is he going to continue to pursue wrestling at the highest level and challenge Swerve for the world title at All In and give it all he's got? Or is he going to think about riding off into the sunset and starting the next chapter of his life? Bryan has promised a big conversation and to share his thoughts tonight on Dynamite. By the time folks are listening to this, they've already heard what Bryan had to say. What's your hope for Bryan Danielson in the future of his wrestling career?
Stay safe, stay committed, and enjoy the ride. He deserves all the accolades and the positivity that he can muster. He's earned that. So, and I hope that, at Wembley that he's in a key spot where he's going to lace him up one more time. Because if you know, if he does on that type of stage, he's going to be, it's going to be special. This card at Wembley is shaping up to be nothing short of extraordinary. And it's got a lot of personal motivation for a lot of the fellas. Think about how, like Will Ospreay, a Brit who as a kid saw events at Wembley, whether it be soccer or whatever. I'm just I'm very jazzed about this card, and I think it's going to be tremendous. I think it's going to be a great night. I hope I'm booked. Well, quite honestly, I hope I'm booked and can add to the sound that you hear from that show.
You're going to hear our show next week, right here, each and every Thursday at grillingjr.com. Be sure to hit that subscribe button, turn on the notifications bell, and we'll see you next week talking all things Vince McMahon federal trial and JR leaving the WWF again right here on Grilling JR.
I just can't get along with anybody. It doesn't seem like that. God almighty. What the hell's going on here? But we appreciate everybody's support. Every week, we've been doing this show a long time. We have fun doing it. It's not rocket science. It's not brain surgery. We're talking wrestling. And we are very blessed that you guys make us a part of your day or your week, whatever it may be. So thanks again for tuning in. We love you guys, and you're very important in my life. And I know Conrad, same.
Absolutely.